are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1944 Brooklyn, newborn Michael J. Hardy is rejected by his mother so she can run with gangster Bugsy Siegel, Hardy's godfather. Shirley Rook quickly rose to the top of the criminal ranks. As the queen of New York City crime, she laundered mob money, ran the city's largest bookmaking operation, and handed payouts to dirty cops, politicians, and judges. To win his mother's love and respect, Hardy became a fearless gangster. Throughout his career as a criminal, he robbed banks and drug dealers alike, ran a finger of an international stolen car ring, kidnapped drug lords, and even became a hired gun. At his lowest, he ended up doing time for his mother's counterfeiting operation in Mexico's most dangerous prison. Hardy's criminal code of conduct combines elements of tough Ukrainian Jew and warm Southern Baptist. Whether dealing with family and friends or fellow inmates during a combined 26 years spent in prisons and jails, he maintained this characteristic gregarious strength throughout his astonishing life, which Hardy was shot 11 times, committed 14 hits from the mob, twice wore wires for Rudy Giuliani to nab dirty cops, wrote a letter to JFK to get out of military prison, choked the Hillside Strangler, shared prison time with notorious criminals, and even spent 10 years in Hollywood working as muscle for a B studio, where he was even cast in non-speaking roles. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Last Jewish Gangster, The Early Years, with my special guest, author David Larson. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, David Larson.
Good evening.
Thank you so much, David, for joining me here to talk about The Last Jewish Gangster, The Early Years. Right away, let's get into how this extraordinary meeting came to be, your meeting with Michael J. Hardy in San Diego. Tell us when this was. How old was Michael J. Hardy? How old were you? Tell us about the particulars of this extraordinary meeting.
Well, Hardy was 69 at the time, in a wheelchair. He had lost half of both his feet to diabetes, weighed about 325 pounds. The person who introduced us, I didn't find out till months later, was his therapist. His therapist had heard me read an opening paragraph for opening paragraph slam competition in town, contacted me through LinkedIn and made the introduction via email. So I never met his therapist till months later. I was put in touch with Hardy. He said his schedule was wide open. He was living in Section 8 housing on fumes in a little studio apartment, a converted garage. And we met at a little restaurant on El Cajon Boulevard in San Diego. And he was quite something from the first moment I laid eyes on him.
So tell us more about this exchange. What exactly he thought you were there for and why you were there?
Well, Nick Pileggi, who wrote the books and the screenplays for Goodfellas and Casino, had arranged for a Hollywood hanger-oner by the name of Bobby DiBrino to work with Michael Hardy to put together a book deal, a movie deal. Nick had arranged for Hardy back in 1990 to sell a portion of his life story to Buena Vista Pictures, and they made a movie. Hardy got $150,000 for his case, for his involvement. He was to be involved also in the promotion of the movie. However, just before it was released, he was arrested for murder. So Disney, Buena Vista Pictures, just scrapped the launch and quietly released it to no fanfare. Patrick Swayze, Halle Berry starred in the film. So Hardy was looking at Bobby DiBrino, who he met 2 years before he met me, as being his next savior. And DiBrino was just not up to the task. He put together meetings. He even videotaped Hardy, had him come up to Hollywood, sent a car for him. Hardy liked that. Oh, I'm important and all. And everything just fell apart. The guy's follow through was non-existent. So Hardy was left holding the empty bag. So when his therapist suggested he might have found her writer. He had heard me read this opening paragraph. Hardy was just salivating, said, please. So that's how we got introduced anyway.
So what did Hardy believe that you would bring to this project that no one else could? And tell us about the process of being able to convince him that you were truly the person to be able to do this story.
Well, as it works out timing wise, he was just desperate because this is his last chance. His health was failing. His wife was there bidding, taking care of his all these little needs. She would exit the house for 15 minutes to have a cigarette, and that was her break away from him. So he was, in a way, he was desperate and he had no other choices, but he liked that opening paragraph I wrote. And I said, well, let's just start meeting once a week and see how it goes. And I would take copious notes. And for months, he just told me what he did. He bounced all around. He robbed this drug dealer and he partnered with these guys. He robbed banks. And then he was in Hollywood doing this, met this actor, and he went somewhere with Ben Gazzara, Stuart Whitman. He was dropping all these names, Chuck Connors. He partied with him a lot. And after a while, I used the tenets to listen, accept, and encourage. I never challenged. I just listened, accepted, and encouraged. And sooner or later, instead of telling me what he did, he told me why he did it. And that was fascinating. That as soon as he opened that door, and I realized the impact that his mother had on his life, her rejection of him, and then how he spent the better portion of his life trying to prove to her he was worthy of her love.
So you go to him every week for, you say, 2.5 hours or so for this process to be able to, as you say, he eventually tells you the why. So obviously you have to go back to the very beginning and talk about who his mother was and the relationship that he had that he struggled with his entire life. As he did, he took you back, take us back, take the audience back to the beginning.
Well, he goes back to his very first memory as a child, and it was of his grandmother and her smells and scents, the gavilta fish and talcum powder in his crib, then sitting on his daddy Roy, his grandfather, his southern grandfather's lap, and his grandfather tickling him, and the time they would spend together, and holding his grandmother's hand, going to school, meeting kids, and the traditions. The great-grandfather Abraham would, every Friday night and Saturday night, were just huge family gatherings, and everybody, uncles and aunts, all brought a special dish, traditional Jewish dish. They went to synagogue. He was just steeped in a lot of that until his grandfather died when he was 8. His great-grandfather died. And then just everything traditionally surrounding the Jewish faith fell apart. And he really clung to his grandfather, Daddy Roy, at the time. But his mother would interject herself into his life. One time she happened to come by her father's house for breakfast and noticed Michael had some red marks on his neck. And where did you get those? And Michael would say, well, my teacher, you know, grabbed the back of my neck because I was out of line going to the fire drill. And these were welts on his neck. Like, and so she showed up that afternoon and threatened to kill the teacher, cut off her hands. And the teacher never came back to the school. And Michael was proud of that moment. But then he realized later on, he was just like a possession. It could have been her car was scratched and she would have reacted the same.
Tell us who his mother is. And we, in an introduction, she ran with all these people. But how did it come that she, this Shirley Rook, became, number one, interested in these people, but became involved with these mobsters?
No one in the family could quite understand how at 15 years old, she had bright red hair, just really stunning, would go to Midnight Rose's candy store and hang out with all the hitmen and the people that would drink there. And she would have them light her cigarettes and wear her seam stockings. And she was just attracted to these guys. In 1943, when she was 18, Bugsy Siegel arranged for her to do a screen test in Hollywood. And she was that steeped and that involved. And he flew her out to Hollywood. She screen tested and they told her that she was a nice, talented redhead. But they started rattling off. We got Lucille Ball. We got Greer Garson, Rita Hayworth, you know, just da, 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 da. And said, "You're talented, but we got a full stable under contract altogether." So she went south to San Diego to go spend some time with her aunt and lick her wounds. And that's where she met her first cousin, Roy. He looked like a cross between the actor Jim Davis from Dallas and Rory Calhoun. Big, tall, 6'1", 6'2", dark, wavy hair. And they hit it off, and they hit it off too well. She got pregnant. So Hardy was born at two first cousins. That was a shame that his mother carried with her, and that's a shame he carried. So when she got back to Brooklyn, she just dumped Michael Hardy with her parents to raise so she could keep on running with the mob. And her involvement with Meyer Lansky kept on growing. After Bugsy was gunned down in 1947, she took up with Joey Adonis and then started running Dirty Money down to Havana to launder for Meyer Lansky. During the 50s, they set her up with the largest bookmaking operation in New York City. She had dozens of apartments set up with telephone lines running in and out, big numbers racket. And she had the protection of the mob. Anytime the police came around, it was just taken care of. And she handled payouts to dirty judges, politicians, and cops. So there was a steady stream of cars that showed up in front of her apartment or brownstone all the time. And she had a nice little money box in her buffet that she would pull out. There'd be envelopes in there with someone's name on it. And she would just hand those. They'd give her a peck on the cheek and shake her hand. The double park men would be on their way. And so Michael grew up seeing all that. He kept on coming around her, wanting to be near her, figure her out. And she'd keep on shooing him off like he was a fly just buzzing around. She didn't want anything to do with him.
That feeling, that idea was reinforced because he had three sisters. And unlike his sisters, they weren't rejected by his mother. At least that's what he believed, that his mother was abandoning him, rejecting him. And he didn't understand why. What about Michael's real father? And he also notices and realizes the way his mother treats not only her husbands, but also all men in her life.
Yeah, she treated, unless she could control her husband, her men, she treated them all like slaves. Bugsy Siegel didn't allow it, so she was more attracted to him. But she married a cop at one point, which is just amazing. That she would marry someone in law enforcement, but that was another way of getting additional protection for the rackets she was running. She had a history from Michael's perspective of just using her men any way she could. One of the last husbands she had was a federale from Mexico that saved her from being raped in prison. She treated him she made him sleep on the floor. She did dishes. Wow. He worked at a Hojo's. You know, just get out of the house, keep yourself busy, you know. And he wanted a child so bad. He thought she was 10 years younger than she was. So she showed up one day. Michael was running a stolen car ring. I'm driving cars out to the West Coast, and she was selling them. They'd split the money, about $1,200 a car. He showed up one time with a baby. "Where'd you get it?" He said, "Well, I know you're pregnant." "No, no." She had bought the baby from someone in Mexico, and she was going to get some assistance for it. And that was just another scam of hers, and it was going to keep her husband happy that she had a baby. And he ended up going to Tijuana partying and got in trouble and thrown in jail for 5 years. So it kind of took care of him. She quietly divorced him. And she couldn't get the paperwork she needed because the baby's birth certificate looked like it was obvious forgery. So she just gave the baby back to someone.
While she is attaining this role and attaining this height of success within the organized crime and the people that she's connected to, Michael J. Hardy is struggling with, obviously, the rejection from his mother. He has this good influence in his life, you say, about Daddy Roy and this family in North Carolina. So despite this, you know, what he describes as this really shaping of his character due to the good influence of this family and this other life other than what his mother subjected him to, he still has a lot of anger. And you say this is part of the why. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that anger just festered. is probably the best way to describe it. He just didn't understand. He had a father that was just basically a street hustler in San Diego that he's just met once when he was 19 years old. He was flown out to California to go spend some time with them while they were getting the right judge to handle an assault case surrounding ice cream delivery. That's a story in itself. And then he saw what his father was like, getting these cheap little knockoff watches that were supposed to be Rolexes or something less. He'd pick them up for $1.75. He'd try and sell them in a bar somewhere, pretending he was a merchant marine on tough times. And he brought his son along to try and add to the plea a little bit. He just saw his father scamming people. And his father took him down to TJ to think he was going to get his son laid for the first time. You know, and the boy, Hardy, looked at his father just like, who are you? You know, even took him to Hollywood to introduce him to some people. It's just trying to impress him, trying to be his father, but he was so far from it. Hardy's the control over his life as far as a male influence all stopped when he was 12 years old when his grandfather died. And his mother didn't even let him go to the funeral in North Carolina. He had to stay home. And he tried to commit suicide, went into his aunt's medicine cabinet, took a bunch of pills, curled up in a ball in her bed. He woke up in a hospital with his mother standing there, berating him because he was so thoughtless. She had to drive all the way through the night back from North Carolina. Who does he think he is? So you can see how a kid would grow up feeling so alone and disjointed, not belonging to anything.
Yeah, you write that there's an altercation at some point and some disappointment when his mother is late to pick him up. And so he complains. He really complains. He's really distraught. And she says, grow up, be a man. And it sounds like that's the last thing you want to say to this guy, at this young boy at this time. And then you chronicle all this delinquency. And I mean, at an early age, he's doing things that much older people would be doing. And he realizes the power of the gun, as you write.
When he was to avoid some law problems with the law, his uncle moves down to Florida and Hardy goes along with him and he gets a rifle to begin with and eventually trades that in for a Roscoe, a revolver. Mm-hmm. And he practices out in the Everglades, shooting palmetto bugs and just becoming very accurate, very comfortable with the sound of the pop and the recoil of a gun. And when he goes back to Brooklyn, he takes that gun with him. And it's a year later, and he's bigger, and he's filling out jackets bigger, better. And he forms a gang at his school. And the first time he uses a gun on another person is when there's a big gang fight after school against a group of kids called the Corsair Lords. He fires one shot in the air and then fires shots in their legs when this crowd of nearly 100 are coming at him and his buddies. They were about 12. And after that, when they all meet at the local pizza place, that's when he realizes, looks around the table. Now he's gone the way of the gun now. He can't hang around these boys anymore.
What happens with his mother and with his uncle Morty in almost all of these court proceedings, despite the serious trouble he gets in for quite a while? What happens in these court proceedings and why?
Well, if it's activity up in the New York area, and there's always a judge and a lawyer that his mother or Uncle Morty arrange, and it quietly gets quashed. If it's down in Florida, her reach doesn't extend down there. So he's got to do his first time. He spends, I believe, 3 weeks in a home where he's got to follow the rules. He's never supposed to come back to Florida again. That's part of the deal he makes with the judge. And she intercedes when she has to, and she's really upset that she's being bothered by the activity. But she is a legal guardian, so she is called upon every once in a while to dip her toes into those unwanted waters of taking care of her son.
Now, tell us, fast forward a little bit to how he progresses. While his mother rises in the ranks and does well and cements her role with organized crime, he is making a name for himself and is getting noticed by some people. What kind of crimes is he getting noticed for, and what kind of behavior is he getting noticed for, and noticed by who?
Well, some of the activity he gets involved in, it just because he's so brash and he's looking for ways to make scores, he runs into the Gotti brothers at one point. And this is before John Gotti becomes John Gotti. John and his brothers, Richie and I'm trying to remember the name, Gene. Richie and Gene Gotti, they rip off a Seaview bowling alley, a couple $1,000s, big score. They're out partying and Gene and Richie come and find them and they get an altercation and they just beat the living crap out of them. John Gotti finds out about it afterwards and they come hunting for him. And Hardy gets shot twice by them, once in the wrist as he goes to park his car at night in through his front windshield. And then once the next day in a big shootout, where a bullet goes through a door of a car and hits him in the stomach. Each time he goes and gets a gay nurse to mend him up. He even raised his shirt up when I was interviewing him to show that the scar that he, the shot that he took in his belly was still kind of weeping lead from a shot that he took in the early 60s. You know, he tangled with some pretty seasoned people within the mob as well. But he was on the outskirts. He never really worked for the mob. He did hits for them. It was just contract work, though. Again, he was just, you know, got paid $1,000 a piece to go perform hits. And for him, it was hoping that the news would get back to his mother and she'd be proud of him.
He is a very different individual and sees the world entering into war. He shakes hands with John F. Kennedy when he passes through town. He ends up enlisting in the army. Tell us about that.
He tried to enlist early in the year when he was not quite 17, and he had a fake birth certificate, and his mother came in with them. She screwed up the interview. I mean, she couldn't even lie correctly, and that's what pissed him off, because her whole life is a lie. But she messed up the first interview in January, I believe it was. He just had a rage in him and he figured, well, join the military. I'll get to shoot guns. I'll get to do something. Channel it somewhere. Channel that rage. That got stepped on. But then in August of that year, the Berlin Wall went up and there was all this news around at the Mill Basin Racquet Club where his mother had a membership and everybody was talking about, oh my God, another war. It's going to be Germans or the Russians, and to him it was commies or Nazis, and he didn't care which it was. So he sent for his birth certificate because he was born in Coronado Hospital in San Diego, and it came back and he was over 17 and a half and he joined up. And the only time his mother ever cooked him a meal was the night before he left, and she made a pot roast, and he went into the service ready to do wage war against one of those opponents. He didn't care. And partway through, must have been 6 to 8 weeks through basic training, he realized Kennedy was a pussy and they weren't going to go to war. The Berlin Wall was going up and nobody was doing anything. So he decided he'd wage war against the army. He went AWOL and he was finally captured and court-martialed and thrown in the brig for 6 months. When he found out that he was, after he did his 6 months, he was going to go back into basic training again. He took his eighth grade education and wrote a letter to the commander in chief, JFK at the time, and he pulled the Jew card. Now I'm being persecuted as a Jew. And to some extent he was, but 10 days later, a colonel shows up. You want to get out? Party goes, yep, they let him out. But that shame followed him for most of his life. He went and got a tattoo of a big eagle on his left forearm because, you know, a ranger. Well, he was never a ranger. He didn't even finish basic training, but he just felt a longing to be a part of something and just couldn't pull it together.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 97% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women aged 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. Ritual invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. Essential for Women 18 Plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. Ritual has also just released Symbiotic, a gut health supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic all-in-one minty capsule. Just one delayed release symbiotic plus capsule per day supports your gut health with all the quality and traceability you'd expect from Ritual. My wife Lisa and I were initially very impressed with Ritual's successful clinical trials, and Lisa decided to try Ritual's Essential for Women 18 plus. She was dutifully impressed afterwards. And when Ritual for Men 50 plus became available, I began to take Ritual every day as well. It's been over 2 years for me and much longer for Lisa, and we both continue to feel a significant difference every day. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, David, we were speaking about what the military was going to do, what Michael J. Hardy thought the military would do for him. But as you say, it produced nothing but shame and disappointment. What happens after? He's still looking for to belong to something and to someone. What happens in his life?
Well, he starts getting involved and meets a guy by the name of Bobby DiBrino, a buddy of his, and they start stealing car parts. They become like an indie pit crew. They jack a car up. They take its tires. They'll take the alternator and the battery and sometimes the radio. And they'll just do this in minutes, gotten to the point. Then they start stealing cars, which is the next step in that evolution. And then his crimes just keep on escalating. He's smart enough to not get caught. And they case things out in cars and stuff. And he meets a girl along the way, gets her pregnant. Again, he's feeling his way through everything, not quite sure what he's getting into. He ignores the girl that he got pregnant. He meets another one, and he ends up marrying her. For their honeymoon, they drive down to Washington, D.C. He sets up a meeting at the Pentagon because he's going to try and get rid of his dishonorable discharge.
Right.
And what a beautiful honey, let's go to D.C. And oh, by the way, I want to hang out at the Pentagon. So he gets this meeting at the Pentagon. They basically laugh him out of the room. Right. So what are you doing? You went AWOL. You disobeyed orders. You wrote a letter. You broke the chain of command. You wrote a letter to the president. And he was just devastated, hung around there a little bit more on his drive back home. His car broke down just as he pulled into Brooklyn. He swapped it out for another car right away, picked up some groceries, and just walking up to his apartment, just things were where he left them. You know, it's orange on the sink, the little frilly curtains. He was assessing his life. He was stealing car parts. He was working with his uncle who owned a little pet store, and they'd resell a monkey. Because people couldn't handle the monkey, go crazy in their homes. So they kept on giving the monkey back and kept on reselling it. And he's just going, I got to do something different. My life's not going anywhere. And he starts coming out of that. He starts escalating his life of crime.
He not only is participating in robberies, these are violent robberies. So tell us about the banks. And even more worrisome is the drug dealers that these guys are robbing.
Yeah, he liked the idea of dealing with drug leaders, robbing drug dealers, because they weren't going to complain to anyone.
Right.
They're going to go to the cops. He gets a hold of someone's black book, a dealer. He was upstate a little bit in New York. He went up there for a weekend, and he took somebody's black book and started calling up some of these drug dealers and set up meetings. He started taking them down, and it was just so easy. Then he went to a police supply store, and he got some fake badges and started pretending he was undercover cops. And he'd show up, and these drug dealers were going, wait a minute, I pay for protection. He'd tie him up anyway, take all their money, take all their drugs. He was selling a lot of those drugs to the manager of Anthony and the Imperials, just as a way of getting rid of some of the contraband that he had. The banks, he met a couple guys down from Boston that had robbed some banks. When he was out clubbing, he met them. And these guys were talking about needing an extra man, a driver. So he knew Brooklyn well enough. So he set it up. He'd steal a car. They case out the bank ahead of time. He knew the routes, exit routes and everything real well. A certain amount of time, they'd wait out in the car, drop these guys off. They come running back out. They'd have the money. They go split it up four ways. He decided, you know, it was like the kid on the playground. Geez, guys, can I play too? And he said, what does it take for me to get in the game? Well, get a big gun. So he mail ordered for a machine gun. And they wouldn't sell you the whole machine gun. They'd sell you a commemorative Thompson machine gun. And they'd have a fake barrel was full of cement. But the same company would sell you a separate barrel that worked. So he put one together, filled it full of, you know, the cartridge full of bullets. And he went down in his mother's basement and he decided to let loose a couple bursts. That's when he forgot bullets ricochet. He was lucky he didn't get shot. But then he was in the game. Someone else driving the car, he got to go in the bank. He got to yell everybody down. And he just loved that power. The biggest score they had was a little over 30 grand. And for the, you know, for the early 60s, that's big money.
What about his mother? And what about what was being heard by his mother about her son's exploits?
He didn't hear too much back. He kept on wanting to hear it. Her mother's boyfriend knew that he was involved. Her latest boyfriend knew he's getting involved in some shady stuff. Told him to be careful. Gave him the tip to set aside 20% of anything you make. Just set aside for legal reasons. Get a good lawyer. And he just kind of blew it off. His mother just didn't talk to him about those things. As a 16-year-old kid, he came to her and wanted, this is in 1960, asked her if he could do collections for her numbers racket. And she just looked at him and scoffed and said, what, you? What are you going to do? So we'll collect some money. I can hurt people. No, no, Michael, no, no. And she kept on rebuffing him. It just, everything that he ever wanted to get recognition for with her, she just never came through.
He eventually, the law catches up with him and his good luck catches up with him and his mother can't protect him. He does do some time, doesn't he?
Oh yeah. His first big time is down in New Jersey. Her influence doesn't extend across the border too well. He ends up doing 2.5 times at the Bordentown Reformatory. It's an odd fact. In 1985 or so, he's arrested on a gun charge in New York. And had the court clerk properly read his background and figured out how old he was at the time, the killer glanced at the arrest for armed robbery of the Greenville Bar in New Jersey and saw he went to Bordentown Reformatory, assumed that he had to be under 18 when he committed the crime. Well, Hardy was 19. And had he read it correctly, Hardy would have been three-struck in New York. We'd been gone away for a long, long, long time. So he spent 2.5 years at the Bordentown Reformatory. He took that as they allowed conjugal visits. His wife got pregnant. He had a son was born to him when he was in the reformatory. It was a working farm. He got to do everything, cows, chickens. One of the last things he did was graves detail. A lot of the prisoners in there had died and they would bury them. And then 5 years later, his job was to dig them up and they put them in a grinder and used to fertilize the fields. After that, he didn't eat any vegetables there. But he got his GED while he was in prison there. He really had these hopes. There were times where he reset his life. And this was one of them, his first time really doing serious time, 2.5 years in Bordentown, New Jersey. And he got out, got his GED, came back. There was his young son, his wife. They went to live with the mother for a while. And she just nagged him to death to the point where he just had to leave. She kicked him out.
So how does his career develop? You talk about this Franzese. He gets the attention of this person in organized crime, and he's working on behalf of the Pacifico family, I believe. I may be mispronouncing that name. Tell us about his ascent in organized crime and how it gets all derailed. And also, what happens with his mother's career?
Yeah, he got to the point where he was robbing drug dealers, gasoline stations, drops, money drops that were used by the mob. And when he got in the shootouts with Gotti, that's when they got called in for a sit down with Sonny Francesi. That was the second time they got called. The first time was that they used Sonny's name at a nightclub where they got in a big fight and they got called in. Sonny was like, well, it was nice you used my name, but don't. Now, the second time was they had a big shootout with the Gottis and Hardy got shot twice. And Sonny had one of those memes, well, forget about it type of thing. You know, you got shot, forget about it. You got your face beat in, forget about it. You know, I don't need this right now. They were worried about the Profaccis. They were worried about a bunch of guys fighting each other. Stop it, guys, stop it. So he got his hand slapped a little bit that time. And his buddy that he was doing jobs with just decided it was too much. He said, you know, this is a real tight friend that he robbed all kinds of people. He illicit crap games. He'd come in and bust everybody, have everyone drop their drawers, give them all their money, take off, do things like that. They were pretty dangerous. And Bobby Dubrino just said, can't do it. And he ends up being a cop. Dubrino does. And Hardy almost feels like he's been betrayed. He never really deals with that guy again.
Lizzie says there's an opportunity to stop for these messages. You say, meanwhile, you say Dubrino becomes a police officer. So the disillusioned Michael J. Hardy, how does he end up? Because all through this book, what we haven't mentioned is an attorney, a mob attorney named Jimmy Blatt. And he is also interviewing Michael J. Hardy. Tell us about how we get to Jimmy Blatt. Who is Jimmy Blatt and the predicament that Michael J. Hardy is in?
Well, the book starts in 1990 when Hardy's being arrested up in La Jolla, California, for murdering his wife 5 years before. And he's got to find a lawyer. He goes through Robert Shapiro, goes through a couple of big names, and hears from somebody that Jimmy Blatt's supposed to be pretty good. And he ends up landing Jimmy Blatt, who's never worked a murder case before, but he had worked in the court system, had been on the DA side. And Jimmy says, well, if I'm going to, you know, Marcia Clark is on the DA team,
right,
coming after Hardy. And Jimmy says, well, if I'm going to know who I'm defending, who I'm sitting next to in court, you're going to have to tell me more. You're going to have to tell me everything about your background. So Hardy in 1990 and 1991 starts telling Jimmy his story. So about every five chapters, you break away and we break away and Jimmy and Michael are going over some kind of strategy, or Michael's pissed off because he thinks Jimmy is cutting deals behind his back. Something's going on. He's not paying him the right attention. So Jimmy's getting excited about hearing a story about Sammy the Bull Gravano. And Hardy's thinking, what about me? You know, he's just got that kind of ego. But Jimmy's very patient, works through this whole thing with him. It takes him over a year, just about a year before he's able. Jimmy kept on telling him this. The longer we wait, the softer they become. They become less interested. There's another case that takes precedence. We just delay. We just delay. We just slow them down. And Hardy's going nuts. He's being kept in Wayside Supermax with Van Nuys. And he asked to go to LA County to the Millionaire's Row. And because they have better food, he's been there a couple times before. And Jimmy didn't even know about that. Wait. Tell me how you got there a couple times before. And Hardy explained some of those instances. And Hardy convinces him to increase his bail so that it will allow him to go to Millionaire's Row in LA County. There's better food, law library, all that stuff going on. So he's just trying to do anything because he's just so bored, just sitting around doing nothing. And that time is eating away at him. His paranoia, you know, thinking that something worse is going to come out, when Jimmy knows just the opposite. The longer it takes, the less interested they are in the case. Something else pops up that takes over their attention.
But Jimmy is saying, he's coming to Michael and saying, listen, we do have some problems because through discovery, the prosecution, this Marcia Clark, is very aggressive and wants the death penalty. And also that your prior record is going to be very, very influential. And we're going to try to suppress it, but we can't. So Michael is twisting in the wind. even though Jimmy Blatt is trying to reassure him as much as he can, but he can't make guarantees. And Michael's asking for guarantees. In that storytelling, we get to the story about his mother and Michael in Mexico.
Michael, his mother, Shirley, who Michael always called mother and everyone else called Queenie,
right,
which is really fascinating. She managed to take a trip to New York, picked up $4,000 of bad money, counterfeit money. She said it was really thick. You could almost feel it, but it looked great, but it was real thick. And $10 bills and $10 bills. And they tried passing some off at McDonald's, but you know, he couldn't only go so fast, so fast. And she ended up suggesting they go down to Tijuana. Those Mexicans won't know what's good US money or not.
Right.
So they go down to the racetrack, Agua Caliente, and they're go buy a $1 ticket, get $9 change, $8 change, and doing that. Well, they hit a trifecta for $13,000, and everybody's jumping up and down, feeling great about it. And he goes to collect it, and there's a bunch of federales around him that arrest him. Well, he doesn't say anything, but his mother gets all anxious because where's the money? So she sends other people up. There are a group of five of them that went on this trip, and they get arrested. They get nabbed for passing phony money, and they turn around and point down to the crowd, those other three people, Shirley and the other two, and they arrest them all. And they keep them in a Tijuana jail for 16 days. And during that time, mother just keeps working on Hardy, working on it. Please, I can't do the time. I don't know the language. Help me, help me. You know, you do this, I'll visit you all the time. I'll send you money. I'll take care of it. And so Hardy finally agrees. And the first book ends with him, they're opening the doors. They drive across a dusty road in the middle of the day from the Tijuana jail to La Mesa del Diablo, the prison, the world's most dangerous prison. And they open up the doors and he jumps out. And so starts an incredible, he's set to do 12 years there. Secret Service has come down because they're part of the Treasury Department. And they say, hey, we want a piece of this guy because Hardy confessed it was his money. And they said, when he gets out, let us know. Or if he dies, let us know, because we'll be waiting for him. That's just one of the law enforcement agencies that's waiting for him. And from there, Hardy's got to figure out how to survive in a Mexican prison where, check this out. This is about as strange as you can see. Tuesday nights were for girlfriends to visit the prison.
Right.
Thursday nights were for wives. And Sundays, they would open the gates of the prison, let whole throngs of people come in with fruit carts and taco trucks, and they played baseball in the big yard. There were 825 prisoners there. Whole families lived in the prison, and it was just, you could have a gun or a knife, but the rules were you couldn't use them on a guard to escape, but you could use them for self-protection.
Wow.
So this place was just like the Wild West, but with a set of rules that... And a month or two into his stay, now this is in the second book, a gay drug lord that cut a competitor in half with his whole family to bring him in. This guy starts doing all kinds of building himself a great big plaza suite, all these other little apartments around there instead of the little hovels that they had before. And eventually Hardy goes to work for him as his gringo pistolero, selling drugs to the 25 Americans that are in there and doing collections for him. And he's observing. They have restaurants. This was also most dangerous, but it was the most entrepreneurial prison. They had restaurants in there, a jewelry store. You could go set up a business there as long as you gave kickbacks to the comandante. There was an ex-NFL player that Hardy became real good friends with that was always planning prison escapes. There was, and Michael's mother, through all this, never showed up, never sent money.
Let's get to how he ends up being arrested for his wife's murder and the relationship and the role his son Robert had in the entire affair.
Robert, speaking of which, got out of prison about a year ago. He was the first prisoner in LA County to be three-struck. His specialty was armed robberies. Home robbers,
right?
Burglaries. Robert was in prison. Hardy's mother died on July 4th, 1990. 4 months later, Robert was in the visitor's room at Corcoran State Prison, caught the eye of a pretty girl, started chatting a little bit, and he decided he wanted to get out of prison early. So he contacted the authorities. They set up an interview. He drew them a map of where Hardy's wife was buried. Now, this was not Robert's mother, but 5 years before it was Thanksgiving, Hardy's wife came at him with the .38, fired a couple times. He shoved her. She cracked her head on a sink. They went to bed later on that night. She calmed down. He woke up in the morning. She was dead next to him. So the son, Hardy wrapped her in a rug, put her in a huge toolbox, and his son eventually, a day or so later, helped him bury her in the backyard. So the son draws the authorities a map of where the body's buried. The authorities look at each other and say, well, thank you very much, but we aren't going to give you an extra time off. You know, you're aiding and abetting in a murder, right. You know, disposing of a body. I mean, got all these charges there. Just be thankful we don't charge you with anything else.
Right.
So they got a warrant out for Hardy's arrest. And that's when they collect him in La Jolla. And then they take him up to the Vista Jail. And then some detectives from Van Nuys managed to come down and pick him up and take him up to L.A. So starts the long process of eventual sentencing for murder.
You say something, or you write, and it seems profound, that he said that his son, Robert, would have never ratted him out if Shirley was still alive.
He really believed that the influence his mother had was so strong that there's no way her grandson would have turned Hardy in. Hardy actually looked at it, even from the grave, she reaches out and she grabs me and she pulls me down. You know, he did have a chance in May of 1990, before she died, to have a little come to Jesus with him to find out why.
Right, right.
She just never understood. She was just used him or just cast him aside. And she just admitted finally she didn't know what to do with him. He was a mistake baby. She was scared. You know, that didn't assuage him much, but at least it gave him an answer.
I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the last Jewish gangster, the early years. For those that might want to take a look at this work, is there a website for this book, David?
Yes. Go to thelastjewishgangster.com.
Thank you very much, David Larson, The Last Jewish Gangster, The Early Years. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening.
Oh, thank you so much, Ron. Good night.
Good night.